The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on December 17, 2008. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
From time to time, people have asked me to talk about physics a little bit. Maybe some of the things that I discussed and brought up in my book, How the World Can Be the Way It Is. Can I ask how many people here have read that book, How the World Can Be the Way It Is? Oh, well, plenty of you. Well, then, you all belong here. The rest of you have to leave. No. I'm not on? There I am. I can hear myself now. Okay. Where was I? People have asked me, why don't you do something out of that book or work with that a little bit or talk about physics more and that sort of thing. When I was writing that book back in the 80s, I did some lecturing at the Minnesota Zen Center off and on several times a year. I had a chance to do some lecturing there. And since I was lecturing, I took that opportunity to discuss some of the things that I was working on in that book that I wrote, How the World Can Be the Way It Is. And at that time, I developed kind of a reputation, I guess, for being a bit of an egghead and an intellectual and all of this. And so I've been reluctant to really use a lot of physics or science and math and that sort of thing in my lectures ever since. And though from time to time I do, as you all know if you've come to some of my talks or a number of them. But this time around I thought, well, people have asked me to talk about this a little bit, and I was reluctant to really take time on in a more general way, like on a Sunday talk, for example, or even really to do a course where we looked at some of these examples directly. But I thought, for those of you who are interested, and I thought it was just a handful of you, I would just do this, and then anybody who comes, so that now that you're here, you're going to be stuck with this, so I'm going to show no mercy. And I'm assuming now that you know a few basic things. I'm not going to talk about or explain, say, like the wave-particle duality and that sort of thing. A number of things that we have talked about before in a number of different contexts. I will assume that you know that basic stuff, and then we'll take it from there. Any stuff that I might be bringing up now that I haven't really discussed or brought up before that I might not feel that you have any reason to know, I might do some explaining there, but I'm not going to go back into just, you know, really basic things. Okay. I had to exacerbate my reputation, that problem, by eventually teaching Nagarjuna. And I must be doing a terrible job at that, because I think people still think, oh, that is so intellectual. They don't understand. And I guess I'm not making it clear that Nagarjuna saves us from getting lost in our conceptualizing and lost in our thinking by simply showing us that all the stuff that we would construct that way, as a mental thought construct, is going to be contradictory. It's going to be a mismatch with reality. That is what he's pointing out. So he actually frees us from that, getting lost in our storylines, our thinking that somehow we can grasp reality and put it into a mental construct of some kind. That is basically what he's about. So then to think that it is so intellectual, I think, is kind of not really understanding that most fundamental point. The fact is that we, as human beings, we tend to be intellectual, meaning that we think, we conceptualize, and then we try to understand our experience through that. What the awakened do is that they point something out to us. They point out our confusion. They point out how we get locked up in mental constructs of various kinds. And they point out that this doesn't really match reality or what it is that's actually being experienced. And that's something that they always point to. So the awakened, they point. They don't explain. They're just pointing out what our experience actually is. And it so happens that, and sometimes people too, we study this way, and you wonder, well, why physics? Why do you ever mention that once in a while? Well, it's because if you consider the teaching of the five skandhas, one of them, you know, the first skandha, rupa, It's form, means matter. That's the physical aspect of our experience here. And if what we're interested in doing is looking very carefully at what our experience is, well, a fifth of that experience, according to the Abhidharmas, is physical. There's physics, okay, the study of the physical world. So there is a kind of an interfacing here that we could easily run into if we study this way, study this practice. And the awakened teachers of the past have certainly pointed these things out to us on many occasions. And here we have something from Dogen Zenji. This is in Book 4, Section 7 of his Record of Things Heard, the Shobo Genzo Zumonki. Dogen says, "Students of the way, the fact that you fail to attain enlightenment," just think about that, "the fact that you fail to attain enlightenment is just because you retain your former views." Think about that for a minute. The fact that you fail to attain enlightenment is just because you retain your former views. I would say it's just because you retain views. I mean, right now, that's what we are probably doing. We are holding views, beliefs, ideas, mental constructs about the world. Not just the world of thought and feeling, but the physical world itself. We retain these views, and as a result of that, we don't see what is actually taking place, what is actually happening. So Dogen goes on, he says, "Although you do not know who originally taught you, yet you think that what is called mind is thought and knowledge." You think that what is called mind is thought and knowledge, or we could say thought and knowing things conceptually. That's what we think. That's what we think knowledge is, generally, knowing things conceptually. Well, knowing things conceptually isn't really knowledge at all. It's belief, it's holding ideas, but it is really not knowledge if knowledge is about actually realizing reality. That would be true knowledge, which we might otherwise call wisdom. But he says, although you don't know who taught you, yet you think that what is called mind is thought and knowledge. He said, now this is where what I want to get to here. He says that when I say that the mind is plants and trees, you don't believe me. Plants and trees, these are physical things. Okay, here now we're going to get into physics here. But he says, plants and trees. Okay, this is mind. The mind is plants and trees. But you don't believe this. Well, this, of course, maybe this is the translation here too. I wouldn't necessarily say that this is something for you to believe. But he's just pointing it out, that mind is plants and trees and tiles and pebbles, as he's about to say here, though he says it a little differently. He says, when I speak of Buddha, you think that it must have auspicious features and a radiant halo. So you speak of Buddha, some ultimate reality here expressed in the human world. It must have auspicious features and a radiant halo. He said, when I explain that Buddha is tiles and pebbles, it startles your ears. And maybe we think that Dogen is just, I don't know, being poetic, or he's just playing games with us, that he's speaking figuratively. He surely can't mean this. Tiles and pebbles are Buddha. Mind is plants and trees. But that's what Dogen says. And he says, the fact that you fail to attain enlightenment is because you retain former views. That mind is thought and, well, conceptual thought. Mind is thought and knowledge. The reason I'm starting out this way is just to get you thinking about this and looking at this and trying to turn your attention back to the original experience, because this is what the awakened are doing. They're pointing out the contradictions, the mistakes, the conceptual mistakes that we fall into, the ideas that we hold. no one ever taught you, no one ever told you that enlightenment is good and delusion is bad, and yet you probably think that. You probably believe that. You probably operate out of an idea that, yeah, enlightenment is good, delusion is bad. But the awakened have never taught that. I've never heard my teacher say anything like that. I had views like that at one time. But at some point, I had to come to realize that, hey, nobody actually really taught me this. Other students around me would talk as if maybe we kind of thought in this way. It's a kind of a natural way to think. But it is holding to some peculiar view that we've just kind of made up. Nobody ever gave it to us. And as a result of holding that view, and as long as we continue to do that without reflecting on what we're doing and realizing what is being pointed out here, we're not going to wake up. We will retain our former views and remain confused. And so then when Dogen says that reality or mind is plants and trees, Buddha, another word for, well, reality or mind, is tiles and pebbles, he means just that. Okay, you have to understand, if you're interested in awakening, you have to understand that Buddha, mind, reality, is tiles and pebbles, plants and trees, not something other than, leave out reality for the time being, but just mind. It is plants and trees, tiles and pebbles. Okay? Mind is more than that, I suppose we could say. But just understand that. Now, if we're interested in physics, if we're interested in looking at that part of our experience that deals with the physical, and if we want to see how that might be handled by the awakened, how they would speak of this, then we have to bear this in mind, that plants, trees, tiles, pebbles, this is mind. And, you know, sometimes too, another point I wanted to bring up at the beginning, when people, you know, think of me as in some of the teaching that I've done where it's so intellectual and it's all egghead kind of stuff and that sort of thing, I've also had people say, well, why do you use physics to support the Buddhist teachings? Well, I don't use physics to support the Buddha, and I don't rely on these examples to somehow shore up what it was that the Buddha taught. But I happen to be interested in some of this stuff, and I've studied some of this stuff, and I can see how what it is that physicists looking very carefully at the physical world have uncovered about the physical world is actually predicted or explained or pointed out in Buddhist teachings. So it is, and I think, if I can do this correctly, I don't know if I can tonight and if we'll even have time for me to bring out everything I want to bring out, but if I did, I think you would see that, in fact, it is actually what the awakened have pointed out about our experience. That actually supports physics and not the other way around. Okay, because, you know, physicists, we're all aware of this, I think, if you come to a class like this, they've uncovered some pretty strange things about the physical world. Absolutely mind-boggling things about the physical world if we believe that physical stuff is something separate and apart from mind. If we didn't see our experience in that way, none of what they have pointed out is really all that strange. But when we think that things are something separate and apart from me, having this mind here with my consciousness taking that in from out there, yeah, then it all seems very strange, utterly baffling, and we can't explain it. But if we understand what the experience is, even as it's been uncovered by physicists, and anything that they will uncover, I swear, will not be that strange to one who is awake. They might not necessarily anticipate all the possibilities of things that could be uncovered, but when they are uncovered, they're not going to be that strange. So I'm pointing that out just to hit off any arguments that maybe I'm somehow going to use physics to support Buddhist teachings. Now, I will use Buddhist teachings to support some strange things that physicists have pointed out to make them maybe not quite so strange. Another quote here by Wang Po I want to read too before we start. Another awakened view about all of this. Wang Po says, all Buddhas and ordinary people are just one mind. Okay, Dogen says tiles and pebbles, rocks, trees, whatever, planet, you name it. This is mind. Okay. Wang Po says all Buddhas, ordinary people, are just one mind. This mind is beyond all measurement, names, oppositions. This is it. What is it? Just this. Okay, our conceptualizing mind will want to put something. It wouldn't mean this. There's something there we can get hold of. Well, we can't get hold of this. You know what I mean by this? Just this. You know, this is not nothing. But it is not something either. If it were something, then we would be able to get hold of it. We're always reaching for that which we can get hold of. Conceptually or physically, in any possible, we just try to get hold of it. And that's where we go wrong. We don't realize that it is mind. You can't get hold of mind. We think, well, I can get hold of rocks and pebbles and plants and trees and whatever. Yeah. Yeah. Enough so that we're deceived. What are you getting hold of when you get hold of something like that? Well, there's different ways of looking at this. But if we look at very carefully at what we think we're getting hold of, you realize you haven't really gotten hold of anything distinct and definitive or separate apart from the holding, or for that matter, you, whatever that is. What are you anyway apart from that? That is being now felt or thought or experienced in some way. Mind is reality. Mind is the foundation of reality. And you go through all of the strange things that physics has uncovered for us, leaving us baffled. The whole physical world itself just seems so utterly unreal and strange. And mind is just still going on. No, no problem with mind. So he says, mind, which is, he says, it is just this, it is just, you know, this is it. It's beyond measurements, beyond names, oppositions. And then he says, as soon as you stir your mind, how do you stir your mind? Well, in thinking. Okay, in forming ideas once again, getting some conceptual grasp of, well, here we're talking about the physical world, but of anything really. He's stirring your mind. He says, then you turn away from it. You turn away from what? You turn away from, well, just this, reality. Turning away from this one mind. And he goes on to say, he says, just that ordinary people cling to forms and seek outwardly. Yeah, something out, separate and apart from you. And he says, the more you seek Buddhahood or this enlightenment, just realizing just this, he says, the more you lose it. Okay, well, that's what a couple of awakened people have said. Well, what I thought I would do tonight, in view of what they said, would be maybe review some strange things about the physical world. But before I do that, first I'm, oh, I forgot a prop. Oh, well, I'll have you use your imagination instead. But I want to draw your attention to this diagram here, which I worked very hard on making it, you know, what I wanted there, but just plain white, blank sheet, right? Now, for those of you who might be listening to this on the CD, I'm sorry, I'm going to use a few diagrams here. But what I'm pointing out is just a plain white board. Okay, we can use this to represent mind. This mind that is tiles and pebbles and plants and trees. This mind that is just this. This is it. Okay. Here it is like this. This is it. Okay, it's like that. Well, except there's no edges to it. We can't diagram that. So there's no edges. It doesn't even really have dimensions of height and width or even depth. Though this doesn't have much. So this isn't really a very good model. There's no boundary. There's nothing outside of it. It is undifferentiated in every possible way. No names, traces, comparisons. Wang Po speaks of that elsewhere. That's mind. Okay? You have to remember this. This, now and forever, always has been. This is mind. It is like that. Okay? Not your mind, not my mind. Mind itself. Mind, I guess we could say with a capital M. Okay, then my prop was, I wanted to have a model of that, another sheet of paper. I was going to put it over here. So just picture, here's it. So we take this, we put it here. That's mind. Can you remember this? This is just a plain white sheet of paper. That's mind. All right? Okay, because I might have to point to that once in a while. That's why I wanted it somewhere in the room. Okay, so it's a brown mind. I don't know. But it doesn't have any color. Okay. But we notice in this mind, even though mind is like this now, but we notice things. You know, like Dogen said, there's tiles, pebbles, plants, trees, whatever. There's stuff there. See? Well, immediately our mind goes to that. Now with that, now we see relationships. You know, we see angles, we see shapes, we see colors, we can see any number of things. There's something there now for the mind to grasp. See, we can't grasp. You can't grasp this. Buddhas don't have hold of this. Buddhas are not holding some idea. Just that they realize, they see this, they see that this is mind, this is reality, it is like this. Okay? But this kind of stuff is showing up within this experience. Mind, as we, you know, turn our attention to just this, it looks kind of like this. This is really what it is. But it looks like this. Can everybody see that, by the way? My beautiful diagramming here? This is quite complex. I might end up with it over there. So, well, what we think, particularly I think people now in our time, our culture, these things that show up, we think that they are things. They are real. Okay, that they're solid. They have a definite shape and form and all of that. And they're distinct and separate and apart from me. They're over there. And then for us that's real. And that they are something. And so the world then consists of something. And that's what we think. The world, does anybody disagree with that? If you're enlightened, you might want to raise your hand. But we think, you know, the world, don't you? I mean, you don't have to be ashamed. Don't we all think that way? There's something, yeah, there's stuff here. Isn't there stuff here? I mean, it's not just in my schematic diagram. I'm just talking about stuff. You know, you said tiles and pebbles, but I could say stools and huh? We operate that way. That's how we... Is it just simply, though, that we're taught? Does anybody teach, you know, bears and cows and other critters? Or don't they act and behave and carry on as if there were stuff?
Sure.
Yeah, I think that they do. With mind, when given the way mind operates, stuff appears here. Okay, and then to whatever degree, probably even among cats and cows, I talked on that koan a while back, cats and cows know what it is. Buddhas don't know what it is. Buddhas, remember that one? Remember that koan? Buddhas don't know what it is. This is what Buddhas know. They don't know it is. We know what it is. Cats and cows know what it is. Buddhas don't know what it is. They don't know that because they know. But they don't know it is. But without waking up to this, we're caught by that. But unlike cats and cows, we can really start doing a lot of stuff with this because of our powerful intellects, our powerful minds, our ability to conceptualize the world is rather incredible. And then we're utterly fooled by it. So we think that this is a world. Let me just show you that world. I'm going to divide it off here now. Okay, that world. That's what we think the world is. And it's a world that, for lack of a better word, is something. That's an S. Something. And we think of that world, you know, Leibniz, 300 years ago or so, he said, you know, why is there something rather than nothing? This comes right out of a deep conviction that we have about our experience here. We think it consists of something. Okay? Remember the awakened. They don't know this. They know how easily we're deceived into thinking that. But they don't see it that way. But we see it this way, and then we, as Leibniz said, why is there something rather than nothing? And many philosophers since that time have spent a lot of time with this, looking at that, considering that maybe being the greatest, the ultimate philosophical question. Why is there something rather than nothing? So we see, that's why I drew that line there, because we will contrast that with this other possibility here of nothing. We might think that, oh, well, isn't that what we had with the Buddha see, with what mind is originally? It was nothing. Well, no, it's not. Tiles and pebbles and rocks and trees, this is mind. You see? Well, isn't that something? That's what we get stuck like this. Our minds, when we're confused, leap between these two possibilities here. Because if it's not nothing, well, then it must be something. And if it's something, well, then obviously it's not nothing. That's kind of where we are, unless we wake up. Okay? As logical and as sensible as this probably appears to us, and it certainly did to me at one time, even now it still does, sort of. But I know better, and I hope I can give you some examples of this, that this is utterly confused. This cannot possibly be the way the world is. It doesn't make any sense. It leaves us with a perplexed mind in which the world itself seems like something rather mysterious. And then we try to use our minds. This is Buddha, seeking Buddha, as Wang Po said here. Using mind to seek mind. Did I read that passage? I can't remember now what I read, but he goes on to say that anyway, whether I read it or not. But you know that passage. We will use our mind to seek mind, to seek reality, to try to make some sense of this. Not knowing where the confusion is. And we're carrying on as if we're trying to figure all this out. Well, there's nothing here to figure out. Because what we need to do is just simply wake up to realize what we have here. We have this. We don't actually have this. So what the Buddha's then, I was going to put a blue line here, but just to, well, I can do that for now. So here's like the edge of the nothing zone. Huh? Okay. Let's move this over. Let's just shift it over, say, to about here. And then we'll move the something over to here, say, like that. Did you get that picture now? So I've separated these two. They're not abutting up against each other like this. The reason I did that is because, what would you call it? So here's our nothing over here. And something over here. Okay. For you listening, I don't know how to help you. But we have something on the left-hand side, nothing on the right. In the middle, got a big blank area there. Okay. In our confusion, when we're occupied with those somethings over there, and think that somehow that's in some kind of existential contrast with nothing, that's all we ever know. We don't notice this at all. But do you notice what this is? You can call it the middle way. But does it look like anything? Well, it's not nothing, it's not something. That's right. Does it look like anything? Does it kind of look like, doesn't it look like this? Yeah, there we are. Okay, so that's how we can find it. It's not, as Sarah Jane said, it's not nothing, it's not something. And in fact, as one of those guys pointed out anyway, Wang Po, I guess, is everything. That's what it is, the one mind. It's called one mind. You know why it's called one mind? Now, how many of these do you think we're going to have? That's it. So here we are. Now we're back. We're back to where we were. Except for one thing. In pushing, if I had a computer diagram, this would have been neater. In pushing this off, like that, you know, separating those two and pushing them off the screen, we still have these kinds of things sitting around, whatever they are. Well, we can even put some over here now. We still have some things. We have things. But when you look at the things, and I'm not going to now talk about the because things could consist of thoughts and feelings as well as things. But this is a class on physics, sort of. We call this Buddhist physics, I don't know. But we're talking about physical stuff, so we'll just keep ourselves to that. So tiles, pebbles, whatever. These things don't go away. Look. Here it is. Maybe I should have brought in some tiles. Well, there's a plant anyway. But there seems to be stuff here. So this is the world now as it appears, as we seem to find it. But if we were to go in and look very carefully now at these objects, in our naive view of these things, they seem to be something. You remember from the, the first year class in describing a body? Yeah, we were getting to the skandhas. Use that quote from Linda Wessels, philosopher, physicist, and she describes a body, you remember? And how basically she says that a body that has a distinct kind of outer shell, so to speak. I'm paraphrasing. The gist of what she said, though, is that whatever a body has, it would have an outside shell or skin or whatever that keeps it distinct and separate from other things. So we can distinguish that from other things that are not part of that body. And it retains this even though it might move and change shape and things like that. In other words, her definition is that these things can be themselves and yet change. And then as she gets into it, this is in a book called Philosophical Consequences of Quantum Theory. And in this book, in this article that she wrote in there, she knows there's something wrong with this definition. That's kind of the whole point of her article. But what? She can't figure it out. Of course, in the course where I pointed out, if you remember from that course, then I gave you a definition of a body by the Buddha. And how did he describe a body? Do you remember?
It gets wet and cold.
It gets wet and cold, among other things. But, yeah, it can get stung by mosquitoes, if we're talking about a human body anyway. And there's nothing contradictory about it. The idea that Linda Wessels had, and I dare say all the rest of us, when we're not awake, is that we can have a body that can change and yet remain the same. In fact, that's what I am. That's what you are. That's what you think you are, probably. You're something that can change and yet remain itself, which, of course, if you think about it, is ridiculous. See, there's something funny about the physical world, the physical bodies that we encounter. When we look at them very carefully, they don't add up. They don't make sense. And it isn't just the little quantum objects, and I've talked to you about, many of you about this before. I'm not going to get into this now tonight. Well, the electron and things like this, the double slit experiment, Schrodinger's cat, where he brings up the contradictions or the apparent contradictions within the microscopic world up into the macroscopic world until it seems like we have this live dead cat. And it doesn't make any sense. That's what the quantum world appears to us to be, something like that. And of course, it doesn't make any sense. Yeah, as we start to look very carefully at the objects of the physical world with our understanding that things are something, that they are themselves and they are separate and distinct from other things, even when they change and move around, they still retain their own identity or whatever. As long as we continue to think that way, what we don't understand, what the awakened have seen in a flash, is that that is not the experience. That is not reality. That is not what is taking place. And as long as you hold that view, nothing is going to make sense. The quote on the poster there that I use and I like from Nagarjuna, he said, "For those to whom emptiness is clear, everything is clear. For those to whom, how would you put it, emptiness is not clear, nothing is clear." So if we're clear on what is actually being experienced, everything is clear. That's why I said at the beginning that I don't use physics. Why would I use physics to support Buddhist teaching when Buddhist teaching points this out. And it can point out what is wrong with Wessel's idea. I'm using Wessel's as sort of a representative of most philosophers and physicists. Not just them, all of us. Though maybe we wouldn't get quite so technical in trying to come up with a description like that. But it is what the enlightened have pointed out about physical experience that can shed some light on what otherwise appears to be something rather confusing about our experience. And there are many ways that the physical world is confusing for us. Yeah, we know about the wave-particle duality. We know about the double-slit experiment, you know, where you put a little detector on one spot so we know which hole the electron goes through, the photon, whatever it is. And by golly, just because we happen to know that, the pattern on the wall changes in the background. Wait, whoa. And of course, that's mind-boggling. Why? Why would the pattern on the wall in the back change just because we happen to know which slit the photon went through? Well, if we understand that these things aren't something in the first place and that mind looks like this, that is not confusing. And I could take the time to explain that now, but I'm not. We have gone over that before. But I want to point out a few other things that I haven't discussed with you before about the physical world. I don't think I've discussed this, at least not recently. But here's another thing about the physical world. I do bring it up in my book, How the World Can Be the Way It Is. You take two physical objects, smash them together at extremely high speeds. That's what they're going to be doing now with that Large Hadron Collider. But there's been plenty of colliders around for a long time doing this sort of thing. What happens? Well, what happens is, in addition to all the innards and parts you might think of these two little particles, you know, they'll like collide a couple of protons or something. Matter, physical matter. They collide, and not only do we find a whole bunch of wreckage, all kinds of other particles, but we actually find two more protons in the wreckage. Okay, so we ended up with more than we had before the collision. Well, where did this other stuff come from? This physical matter, where did it come from? Well, it came from the reduction in speed of the colliding particles. They slowed down and suddenly more matter appeared in the universe that wasn't here before the collision. We're talking about this stuff. It can be made from motion. We're talking about looking at a couple of slits passing a photon through it, and because we happen to spot, if we spot which slit one of the photons goes through, the pattern on the wall will change. This is physical reality. Now, I'm not making this. This is what physics has uncovered for us. And it seems utterly baffling to us when we think and we firmly believe that things are something. Were we to see that things actually aren't something, or let's put it this way, that things are mind, that tiles and pebbles are mind, or mind is tiles and pebbles, or Buddha, as Buddha in this example not being the guy who lived in India, but reality itself is an expression of reality itself. It shows up as tiles and pebbles, shows up as thought and feeling. It looks like stuff is here, but actually all the while it is this. If we were to understand that, then none of this would be baffling to us. Just take ordinary kind of objects, like, I can't draw a perfect square, but let's just pretend that is. Okay. Now, this is something that absolutely horrified the ancient Greeks, who, like all the rest of us, believed that the world was something. They didn't quite get to Leibniz's question, perhaps. I don't know, maybe they did. But they thought, like any of us, that the physical world is something. And so they were absolutely horrified to discover that if we take a square like this, and it's one on each side, one what? What doesn't matter? It's a unit in length on each side. Okay. Now, say it's a sheet of sheet metal, okay, and you get your tin snips out. Better yet, you cut it with your your laser cutting, whatever. The Greeks couldn't have done this, but maybe we could. But anyway, so we cut on the diagonal like this. Okay, and that's not a very good diagonal either. But anyway, but we just cut it like that, okay? So now we have a triangle, the legs of which are one on each side. Then how long is that side? Square root of 2. Yeah, because they knew this Pythagorean theorem, yeah. So that's a square root of 2, yeah. That's nice, we can say something like that, but yeah, this is 1, that's what?
That's irrational.
It's an irrational number, meaning what?
It doesn't repeat, it goes on forever.
It's not even a number. The Greeks, they thought, these are the Pythagoreans, who, by the way, didn't discover the Pythagoras, and it was discovered, they think, by the Babylonians, I suspect, maybe even earlier. But anyway, yeah, they thought that with number, you could take anything we find in the physical world, and you can always express it as the ratio of two other numbers, like that. And what they discovered was, without having to check all the possible numbers, they discovered that, yeah, this was the first discovery of what we now call an irrational number. There is no ratio. You cannot come up with a number. You cannot write this number out. We say the square root of 2 because conceptually that's what it is. It's the square root of 2. You multiply something by itself and that's what you will get, is that. This square has to add up to these two added together. Then whatever that is, you multiply it by itself and it'll give you that square. But can you think of another ratio or object in our world? Pi, yeah. The ratio of a circle to its diameter is also irrational. Now think about it for a minute. This is the physical world, and yet there isn't any number. The Greeks, like I say, they were horrified by this. Here we have this physical world, and yet you're telling me that this isn't any particular length at all. We can't get hold of what that length is in relation to these two. That's what they said. So if you have something here, then you can't have something here. And yet it would seem that we do. Same thing is going on here with that. Well, that started us off wondering about how strange the world was. But we eventually get used to these things, you know. And so we don't, and now we just, well, yeah, so, I mean, you take a sheet of sheet metal and you cut the diagonal, so what? I mean, there it is, you know. Well, what reality does it actually have? Same thing with this ratio. Well, what I wanted to show you now, which I don't have time for, I was going to expand on this, there are all kinds of objects in the physical world that show up in all kinds of strange ways. Well, like, for example, just quickly then, I was going to develop this a little bit more, but maybe I can show you. Light. I don't know how ordinary it seems, but light, we've already looked at it a little bit, like with the double slit experiment, that sort of thing. Light is a kind of a strange thing. But did you know this about light? You shoot a beam of light this way. Then I wiggle it. Okay, we shoot a beam of light that way. Okay, so now it's heading in this direction. Okay, what is light, though? Electromagnetic radiation. Okay, that's light. Radio waves are electromagnetic radiation. That's what it's called because Michael Faraday, fooling around back in the early 19th century, he was an experimenter, and fooling around with this stuff, they noticed, well, they were starting to play around with electricity. Ben Franklin, before that, was fooling around. A lot of guys were fooling around with electricity at that time, and magnetism. And there seemed to be some kind of connection between these two. And it was Michael Faraday who finally noticed that, well, there's this oscillating electrical field that is running like this in the direction that light is moving. Okay? But it's perpendicular. Okay? It's running in this plane. Light is running on this axis. The motion of the light, or the direction of the light, is in that axis. If we draw another axis here, okay, so here's our y-axis, light is, you know, and here's our, no, that's our x, and here's our y. Okay, and so the electrical field is oscillating up and down like that. But the magnetic field, that's, if you picture now another, you know, the XYZ diagrams, you're familiar with those? So this is the horizontal, this is the vertical. Now this is the axis looking in the third dimension here through the board, okay? Kind of looking at it that way. Well, the magnetic waves are running that way, so they're in line with that axis, okay? And the electrical field is, say, running this way. Okay, so far so good, not too hard. So you can kind of see now this one's going that way, that one's going that way. You can kind of see that. Okay, this one is 90 degrees to that one, and 90 degrees to the direction of the beam, and vice versa. The direction of the beam is 90 degrees to both of these. This one's 90 degrees to both the others. Okay, now there's one other property that Faraday uncovered. It's called polarization. Okay, and it has to do with what we call spin. It has a kind of a angular momentum about it, some other property, okay? We call it polarization, okay? But when you have something like that, if you have something spinning, and then it spins around an axis of some kind, right? So it's pointing. So whatever it is it's spinning around is pointing in some direction. Well, what do you suppose the direction is that it's pointing in?
I'm thinking of
this thing?
Yeah.
I'm asking you.
That's what I'm thinking of. It's pointing out there. If it's spinning this way, it's pointing.
I'm not concerned with that. What I'm concerned with is this axis.
Okay.
I don't care which way it's spinning. Well, I'll tell you. This too is at 90 degrees to this and to this and to this. Okay? All four of these things are at 90 degrees to each other. Think about that for a minute. Okay, we live in a world with, I can go forward and back, I can go side to side, go up and down. All right? They're all 90 degrees. This is 90 degrees to this and to this. Okay, they're all 90 degrees. Polarization is also 90 degrees. Where is it? Well, obviously it's involving another dimension. But fourth dimension there. But then don't we even have another dimension? Doesn't this take place in time as well? Isn't that another? But this is a spatial dimension, not a dimension of time. Well, okay, I was going to actually spend a little bit more time developing that, but because there's a lot of interesting things about that. But I hope I've kind of given you the sense of this, just to leave you with this. What I was trying to help you with tonight was just to uncover, and there's a lot more, believe me, about the physical world that is actually mind-boggling to us if we don't understand that the physical world is mind, okay, that its foundation is mind. As the ancients said, that I tell you that mind is tiles and pebbles, and yet you don't believe me. But were we to realize that this is the case, then these kinds of things, I was going to try to show you how it probably wouldn't really, well, it isn't a problem, but and there's many more things regarding this too that I could show you, and it's also kind of related to that hypotenuse that we were looking at. It has to do with motion and movement. We already talked about how if you take motion, from motion we can actually produce matter. Okay, we've already looked at that in one way. There are many other ways of looking at all of this. I'd like to take you through and show you that we actually don't have motion. Motion is a fiction as something. We don't actually have something that can move. It appears like we have things that move, But this motion, what we call motion, is actually a function of consciousness or mind. Same thing with these multiple dimensions. Well, what I wanted to get to with this, showing these multiple dimensions, is as we go into higher and higher dimensions mathematically, I was going to tell you a little bit about some of the interesting mathematics, quaternions and things like this that they use in higher dimensions, which is difficult to understand, but the thing I wanted to point out about these higher dimensions is that as we go into higher and higher dimensions, it might seem like the world then is getting more and more complicated. Actually, it's getting simpler. The most complex world we could have is this world of three dimensions, but the world of three dimensions is a world that consciousness functions in. Consciousness cannot reach into a four-dimensional spatial world, and the very simple test of that is picture where that axis is pointing. We cannot conceive of that. Consciousness is not capable of doing that. Consciousness constructs the world in three dimensions, though the world itself doesn't have any kind of dimensions. Physicists looking down at in string theory and that sort of thing, it makes a lot more sense if they can have a world of, say, 22 dimensions or 53 dimensions, any number of dimensions, and they're cranking the numbers in such a way to get it back into three dimensions, but it's just easier to explain if you have more dimensions. But the point I want to make is that as we go, if we were to move into higher and higher dimensions, we start heading towards something that looks like this. Okay? So it's like the world is like this. It actually is non-dimensional, but it manifests out of something that looks like a multiplicity of dimensions. And it is consciousness that is kind of collapsing the world into this three-dimensional, this apparent three-dimensional space. And consciousness also works, and it was described in Buddhist literature, rebirth consciousness, as it's called, is a kind of consciousness that functions in such a way that gives us the illusion of time, where things are actually moving. Getting back to Linda Wessels again, well, how can we actually have something move and still be what it is, or actually be something? And of course, we can't. Now, with all of this, this constructed world of this and that, the physical world, we say it's illusory. This is, the Buddhists say this. Long ago, they've said it's illusory. Physicists are still hanging on to it as if it's not quite illusory, but it's illusory. The whole thing is an illusion. And we can see this and realize this and know this directly. Physicists have uncovered many ways that kind of show this, that could kind of hint at that. But it's hard for us to treat this as an illusion because it is such a compelling illusion. After all, we can feel it. You know, I'm stepping on the floor, I can feel that. We can see it, we can hear it, all of that. And so it's a very powerful illusion. But also from a Buddhist standpoint, we don't say that it is not real. Obviously it is real. Here it is. It looks just like this. But there's that what is it aspect to this that we can't get hold of it. Why can't we get hold of it? Because it is mind. You try to get hold of mind. Just examine some of the experiences that you have when you hear something or see something or smell something. Just sit down and look at this a little bit and ask yourself, where is this taking place? It has no location. The actual experience that is unfolding has no location whatsoever. It is this functioning of mind that is actually the construction of the appearance of location. But then we are sidetracked into believing, trusting the solidity of and the objective realness of the objects, and we get taken away by that. It is quite possible to see directly the illusory nature of all of this. And this is what awakening is. This is what we awaken to. So it isn't like the Buddhas then were somehow miracle physicists or something like this. It's just that whatever physicists are going to uncover, this is what I said at the beginning, about the physical world, anybody who's awake will probably not be very surprised by it. And probably could anticipate, if they sat around long enough and thought about it, other things that you might happen to stumble on or uncover about the physical world. It is hardly the case of where we need what physicists are showing us about the world to support what it was that the enlightened have pointed out about human experience. Well, I feel like I really kind of rushed through a number of things at the end there. There's some other things I'd like to show you if you're ever interested. Anybody interested in hearing any more? Well, I want to talk more about motion. Motion is, and by the way, this is the one of the reasons I'm also talking about this again is I've gone back to working on what was going to be the sequel to my book, How the World. Never got written because Dharma Field happened. But I'm kind of gone back to that now, and so I'm thinking about some of these things again. And right now I've been working on motion. And I'm telling you, motion is absolutely fascinating. I'd love to show you a few things about that. But I'm going to have to pare down whatever it is I'm going to show you, because I thought I could actually get through all of this and have time left over, but I didn't really do it. But if there's any interest in that, let me know. I might call another seminar. Any of you who are interested in this, you're welcome to come back if I completely, you know. But you were warned. I warned everybody ahead of time. But thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.